Welcome to the Workers Mic right here on 720 WGN, powered by the Midwest Coalition of Labor. My name is Ken Edwards. I am with the Midwest Coalition of Labor. Sitting to my left is Ed Maher with the International Union of Operating Engineers. Buongiorno, Ed.
What's happening, Ken? Happy Sunday.
Happy Sunday to you.
It feels like spring out here all of a sudden.
How was Italy?
Very nice.
Did you ride a Vespa?
I did not. I don't think they make big boy Vespas. They don't have big boy sizes and a lot of things over there.
Yeah, that's a good point. You had a good time?
Yeah, great time.
That's awesome. I went to Florida, by the way.
Yeah, I saw a picture. You caught a little fish. You caught some bait.
It looked little.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know.
It was the camera.
It was much, much bigger in person.
Yeah, I'm sure. So
first of all, I'm glad that you're back. Not that I didn't have a blast with Phil. Phil is...
Yeah, thank you, Phil, for filling in.
Can't thank you enough, by the way.
Did a great job.
And actually, Phil's the one that got the guy from the teachers union to come on.
That was a really interesting
interview. Yeah, it was really, really cool. I don't speak teacher, but I speak it a little bit more now.
Right.
You know, it's definitely it's a different world. And speaking of different worlds, we have a couple of, like, different guests today. We have David Madland.
David Madland, he's from the Center for American Progress. It's a think tank. They put out a really great study this week about the impact of union representation on working class people across America.
And he also really wrote a book, right? He wrote this really, really, I downloaded it last night. I started to read it. Really radical, like everything that needs to change about labor, unions, policy in the United States.
So that this can be more inclusive and impact everybody.
Everybody. Basically, he says his book solves the entire problem for the entire... the United States, all of our problems will be solved by this guy's
wealth
book.
Inequality gone.
Yeah. And then because we have the writer's strike going on,
right.
We have a WGA executive board member. His name is John Rogers, and...
he's going to tell us a little more about what it's all about,
absolutely.
What these writers,
yeah.
And why every human being, every... air-breathing human being should be supporting these writers.
If you're human,
get with them.
Yeah. Otherwise, it's coming for you next.
Right. So we got a lot to talk about. Let's get to it.
So stay with us. We'll be right back on the Workers' Mic, 720 WGN.
You're listening to the Workers' Mic, powered by the Midwest Coalition of Labor and sponsored by Megan Financial, Premise Health, and Voya Financial.
All right. Welcome back, everybody, to the Workers' Mic right here on 720 WGN. With Ed Maher and Ken Edwards. Now, in the initial segment, I mentioned a study that I'd read, and we're lucky to have one of the authors of that study on the phone with us today. His name is David Madland, and David is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress.
Welcome.
And he's also the author of Reunion, How Bold Labor Reforms Can Repair, Revitalize, and Reunite the United States. So, welcome. Thanks for coming on the show, David.
Thanks very much for having me.
So let's talk about the article first. And before we do that, David, you work for basically a think tank, correct?
Yes.
Center for American Progress, think tank. It's been around for about 20 years. You would say if it had a polar opposite, what would the other think tank be?
Heritage Institute or American Enterprise Institute.
So, those are largely
right-wing think tanks.
Yeah, the old Koch brothers money funded think tanks.
Right. So it's good that there is a counterbalance to that, if you will. And you yourself, what's your background?
My background, I've worked for labor unions. I've worked for a member of Congress who was chair of the Labor Committee when I was there, and worked on political campaigns, but I also have the academic side of PhD. And so it's sort of a hybrid between politics and union sort of work, as well as the academic.
There is a Venn diagram that has all of that included, and you must fit right smack in the middle of that.
And the Washington Post actually called you one of the nation's wisest labor scholars. That's pretty high praise.
That's very kind of them. sometimes happen. More often they'll say bad things about me. But
that's all right. And the Washington Post, owned by?
That would be Jeff Bezos,
that's
I think, right?
Yeah. And where did you go to school?
I went to Berkeley for undergrad, and I got my PhD at Georgetown.
Nice.
So what, online? Those are online schools?
Georgetown. I think I've heard of that one.
They just give them to everyone.
You know, it's a nice thing that the kids can get online education nowadays and look where you could wind up.
So the study that you put together that I came across the other day was titled Unions Build Wealth for the American Working Class. And one of the first things that I saw in the study was a definition of working class. I mean, I always assumed that I grew up working class, but I didn't know what it actually meant. So Can you define working class, like how you define the American working class?
Sure. In this study, you know, we define it as people without a four-year college degree. There's certainly other ways you could think about it, whether it's an income level or the type of, whether it's blue-collar work. But this is kind of a definition that lots of academics and sort of political people use, because there's often a sort of a big difference in the sort of kind of income you can earn and the lifestyle you have if you have a four-year degree versus if you don't.
And so, I mean, the findings of this, quickly summarized, would just be unions, the outcomes for union members in the working class versus non-union members in the working class are dramatically different. Unions are extremely beneficial for that group. Could you tell us a little bit more about it?
Yeah, so they're big. As you were writing, the typical working class union household has about 200,000 in wealth, and that's four times the typical wealth for a non union working class household. So these are big differences.
And you're talking about what? Property, you know, money in the bank, you know, your house, et cetera, right? I mean, that's what you're talking
all
about.
All of that, yeah. So wealth is kind of it's add up everything that you've got that's positive, your savings accounts, right. Your house, your retirement accounts.
Your pension.
Subtract out anything you owe, and it's the sort of this net thing. It's kind of a lifetime sort of accumulation of everything you've been able to earn. It's not just what you got one year that you had a good year, you earned something. It's like a really what you got in the bank.
Yeah, I think that goes along with, you know, the studies that say, you know, most Americans are one catastrophic incident away from, you know, bankruptcy or homelessness.
Right. I think the study mentioned that one in three Americans still can't handle an unexpected expense of $400.
Yeah, so that's
scary. That's sort of how that puts into sort of perspective that when you think you're living the paycheck to paycheck, it's because you don't have any wealth to rely on. Yet when you're part of a union, it's transformative, and it's transformative because, you know, probably there's lots of other studies that looked at the good things unions do, like you have higher incomes, you have better benefits, you also have a more stable job. Mm-hmm. And this study, really what it shows is that all of those add up to be so much greater, because it's not just one thing unions do. They do all of this stuff, and that means a whole lot more financial security for you.
And thinking about this in terms of wealth, I mean, we talk all the time about hourly pay and annual pay being better under a union contract, but a term that you use in the study, the union wealth effect, I think it makes me think about it in a different way, because one of the points that you make in the study is children of union members earn more during their lifetime. So this is, unions are creating a foundation for working class people that benefits the next generation and the next generation. So you're really building a family or building something like a strong foundation for your family to continue on for multiple generations.
Yeah, you're hitting the nail on the head there. And that's what, you know, when you think of sort of typical person without a four-year degree, that means they probably didn't have a lot of family wealth. They didn't have sort of the, you know, a fancy college degree and sort of the benefits that might bring. So how do they take care of their family? How do they sort of pass something on? Other people, whatever, they can pass on their estate or whatever fancy things they have. But for a typical person working, a union is sort of an essential way to do that, because you set yourself up with some wealth, and that wealth can then provide all sorts of benefits for the next generation.
And like your kids are healthier, like, you know, here in Chicago and around the Midwest, and I'm sure in other parts of the country, you know, you're seeing, and both Ed and I come from the building trades, David, and you're seeing, you know, we're opening doctor's offices and, you know, getting people in, and they're healthier and their kids are healthier. Ed told me that union household, you know, members live longer, right? They're literally healthier. So, you know, it's just...
Yeah, these are the kinds of, I think studies are getting a little bit more into these kind of things of because wealth, the other thing here is just wealth is so much more unequally distributed than income.
It's, right.
You know, like hundreds of times more unequally distributed. And so that means the life chances for people are so much different. But if you can build a little bit of a nest egg, like unions help you do, these have sort of benefits from so many facets of your life. That's, you talked about health, and these kind of things are being more and more just studied. Or I, you know, mentioned mobility, passing on advantages, so your kids can then have the kind of advantages that someone who has a college degree has, for example. So that's one of the other findings from this study. The typical working class union household has almost as much, not quite, but almost as much wealth as the typical college-educated non-union household. So they're almost closing the gap with the college-educated.
Wow. And I got to tell you, I think that you'll see that shift over the next 10 years, if not sooner, because we are preaching earn while you learn, come to an apprentice program, don't come out with debt. And as these college degrees, in my humble opinion, become less and less useful, I think you're going to see a sea change in that. I want to switch gears, though, if you don't mind, to talk about your book. I actually did download it last night, and I read the introduction. It's radical. I mean, it's absolutely radical. So, you talked about the fact that there needs to be a sea change here in America in terms of labor law, labor policy, et cetera. Can you just touch on a couple of those points?
Sure. So my goal is most every worker should be covered by a union contract, by a collective bargaining agreement. So that means everyone can benefit from all of these things we've been talking about, the greater wealth, the ability to have your family have security and the like. And so then how do we achieve that is what I really want to focus on.
Right.
And to me, there are a couple things you need to do. And the first is about getting far more workers to be members of unions. And that's about giving workers stronger rights, things like the PRO Act, but it's also about really how you incentivize people to join unions so that we can have membership rates like some of the countries like in Sweden, for example. But we also then, I think, want to improve how we bargain so that we're covering far more workers.
So that's when you come to the sectoral bargaining is what you called it, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, and explain what that means. What does that mean?
Yeah, so most of our bargaining in the U.S. is worksite by worksite.
Right.
But when unions are really dense, like you think of the old auto industry, they had something close to sectoral bargaining where they covered kind of all of the workers in the industry, and the gains sort of spread out from there. So everyone in the shop got a good union contract. And that means that the firms don't need to fight unions so much because they're going to pay the same rate kind of whether no matter what.
Right, exactly.
It also means, which is sort of one of the things that unions have been fighting for a long time, is similar pay for similar
equal pay
work.
For equal work. Absolutely.
And it's really hard to get that when you're bargaining just with an individual work site. If you can get to a broader level, right. And you come from the trades. One of the things I talk about is prevailing wages are
absolutely
sort of one of the few things we have that are a little bit like what I want, but I want it on a much bigger scale.
So do we.
So in prevailing wage law, when you're working on doing construction on a government contract, typically the firm has to pay at least the prevailing wage, which when unions are strong, that's the union rate.
Right.
And so all of those workers are benefiting, but also the union is benefiting because their wages aren't getting undercut. Your wages aren't getting undercut.
That's right. And our contractors are not getting undercut.
Exactly.
Right.
And so your firms are succeeding and can compete.
So you're saying to take that and take it to its logical conclusion, which is you do it across a sector, right? Whether it's a service sector or manufacturing sector or whatever. So sectoral bargaining, that's number one. You also say, which is something that Ed and I have been saying since the day one of this show, that the labor policy and the labor the penalties for breaking the law here in the United States are laughable. It's a joke, right? And that needs to change.
It's a crime. It's criminal, of course. Yes. Absolutely. We need real penalties for firms that violate the law. Otherwise, there's no disincentive for them to, go on as they do. As you've probably heard on your show before, the penalties right now are laughably weak. That firms sometimes refer to these as, quote, their hunting licenses. It's just a permit that they have to post. Practically, there's nothing deterring them from all sorts of horrible union busting activities. And that needs to stop. But I'm also for, we need to go well beyond that. Like, that is just not enough. It's not just enough to say you can't do this. We want to really encourage workers to get into unions. So you mentioned these apprenticeship training programs that you all do, which I think are, one of the best things we've got going. You earn as you learn.
That's right.
But as you know, it's also a pipeline for people to get into your union.
Yes.
And so I want to ramp that up and things like that as well. So we're really incentivizing, encouraging people.
And in the process, you build a more skilled workforce for the nation.
And then we have, you know, there's greater productivity gain, so there's a bigger pie, and we can get more of that bigger pie.
So, I mean, one of the things that you mentioned in your book, from what Ken was telling me, is that the political arena here is someplace where workers are not winning. You know, what we see is that unions make a huge difference no matter who you are. They will make your life better. And yet we have a Republican Party that often nationally is pushing policies that are against unions and often against workers, and the Democratic Party, which frankly I think is just distracted from these kitchen table economic issues and focused on things that, you know, maybe fall outside of Maslow's old hierarchy of needs. So, I mean, what do you think needs to happen on the political front to kind of open the floodgates here?
Well, I think you started to get it right. You know, labor issues have to become front and center. They can't, we can't be distracted by all these sort of, you know, whether, you know, cultural issues that are dividing Americans. We all want to find how to make work pay and put that front and center. And there's starting to be a shift. It's nowhere near enough, but there's been some big movements that I think, you know, are important to note. So the public opinion right now on labor unions is more popular. Labor unions are more popular than they've been almost ever.
Right.
Approval ratings around 70%.
Yeah.
So the public,
no question about
there.
It. And unions won 80% of their elections last year. I'm going to cut you off, but and we don't have a lot of time left. But you said something, you know, that I think is something that Ed and I have been saying, that when you take out the, you know, the gun issue, the gender issue, the, you know, whatever it is, the woke issue, blah, 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 all this kind of nonsense that, like you said, is dividing this country and doing a very good job of dividing us, by the way. And you take that out and say, hey, how about this worker amendment on the ballot? So here in Illinois, we passed the Workers' Rights Amendment. Every single county.
Thank you.
Every single county in this state, deep, deep red Illinois, voted in favor of the Workers' Rights Amendment.
Yeah.
Right? So moving everything off to the side, like you said, David, focusing on labor and workers' rights, that has to be the center of attention. And what Bernie Sanders is doing, I think, is important, right? Holding some CEOs accountable and having hearings. It needs to get labor and workers' rights has to get into the vernacular of the American people and politics and culture, you know, and radio shows and television shows and, you know, things like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, your book and what you're doing, I think, is important in that regard. You know, I would encourage everybody to go out and Google this, buy this guy's book, because, you know, it's absolutely fantastic.
And that book is called.
I, of course, agree. Like, we got to make union issues the center of sort of political debate.
Agreed.
Yeah, and the book again is called Reunion: How Bold Labor Reforms Can Repair, Revitalize, and Reunite the United States. And we've been talking to David Madland, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. David, I know you've got to run. Thank you so much again for making some time for us this morning.
My pleasure. Really enjoyed it.
We'll be right back right here on the Workers Mic, 720 WGN.
You're listening to The Workers' Mic, powered by the Midwest Coalition of Labor and sponsored by Megan Financial, Premise Health, and Voya Financial.
Welcome back, everyone, to The Workers' Mic right here on 720 WGN. I'm Ken. This is Ed. We are extremely happy to have with us today John Rogers from the Writers Guild. John, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me on, gentlemen.
Oh, thanks for coming.
Yeah, it's certainly timely. And you are just, your title is, you're on the board of the Writers Guild of America?
I'm on the board of directors for the Writers Guild of America West. I do the legacy issues and the history. There's a Writers Guild of America West and a Writers Guild of America East. We are both on strike.
Okay. And two different locals or two different unions under, two different unions?
We're a guild. I mean, yeah. Technically, I mean, we follow. Look, both of these organizations are 90 something years old. So there's a lot of artifact structure. But we always work in unison. Mm-hmm.
Got it. Okay.
And so, you're on strike.
Yeah, you're on strike. It's a big deal.
On strike, sir. I was out on the lines yesterday.
And what is? Tell us briefly. Let's go back real quick. So, what's your background? You are a writer. Obviously,
I am a screenwriter. I started as a stand-up comedian, and back when they gave every heavyset white guy a sitcom back in the 90s, I did that for a second and a half, and then wound up getting more into the writing side of it, and have been a continually employed screenwriter for like 25 years now, between both features and television.
That's super cool, and I understand that you wrote Transformers.
I was one of the writers. Those big blockbusters very rarely have one person on them, but I was one.
You're
of
modest.
The
yeah, don't be modest, John. I heard you wrote the whole thing, and I heard you hired Megan Fox for it too. By the way, good choice.
Yes, that was the power the screenwriter exerts over a massive blockbuster film is really intimate. We barely even talk to the director. We barely even let him in the
pub. Well, 25-year-old Ed thanks you.
Yeah. All right. So tell us what is this strike about?
The strike is about the fact that we have come to a point where the streaming model, which has been growing over the last 10 years, has disrupted both our compensation and our working conditions to an untenable degree. And so we intended to address this with the companies. The companies, as you may have seen in the press, not only didn't give us what we want, they completely refused to respond and did not counter to many of our very high priority issues. And so, unfortunately, we've come to the point where we are forced to use the power of the union. And thanks to a 98% in favor by the union, with the highest turnout we've had in the union strike authorization vote, unfortunately, the board had to make a decision to call a strike last Monday.
So the companies literally won't respond to some of your proposals. Like, they just are blank.
Yeah, just like, no counter. We're trying to be transparent, so we released because we realize it's the only way to win this sort of thing is to be transparent, because when you see the behavior of the companies, even people who weren't involved in the issues could see the bad behavior on the part of the companies.
Right.
So we released, you can find it online, a document outlining our asks, and they are all very reasonable, and the company's responses. And as you can see on about half of them, it did not respond, and no counter offered. Yeah, they just refused to engage.
I mean, things went with the switch from, I mean, the last time that you were on strike, streaming was just emerging. People heard about it. You know, Netflix was getting away from being the DVD mailing company and into streaming, but people didn't really understand it. And now the world has changed. And I mean, streaming, when you're a writer, you make money when your show airs. You make money when it's syndicated, you know, back when you used to have reruns. But all that's changed now with the streaming era. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, and look, the point of the last strike was streaming, is that we saw this coming and nobody else did, and we decided to strike, and we went up 100 days. And the company told us streaming is experimental, streaming is promotional, we'll never make a dime in this. And literally the day the strike ended, Hulu started.
Wow.
So they had the bullet in the chamber. Yeah, they were ready to go.
Of course.
And so luckily for us, we established that precedent, but now over almost exactly 50% of the business now is producing in streaming and distributing through streaming. So, yes, and that has changed because the contract, the Writers Guild contract, is a living document, and it is amended as we go. And so every new distribution model that comes along, we have to write rules for that distribution model.
Right.
So the rule for reuse of our work, residuals, which are similar to office royalties, are not exactly them for complicated, fascinating historical reasons I could get into, but I don't think anybody really wants to spend that in a minute.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. We get really a percentage of the profits in some places, and we get a flat fee in other places. And then in streaming, we get a fee that is based on the regional sales price that is dependent on the actual size of the streamer.
Okay.
And it is a flat fee. And as a result, we have no share in the success of the product.
Wow!
So you're writing it. It's hugely successful. It's garnering more subscriptions to so and so service. Eventually, by the way, they're throwing ads in there now.
Yeah.
And so it's your product that's being produced. You literally are the ones that came up with the idea and wrote the product, and you're not sharing in the revenue of that product. What other business model is that?
Small way because I'm sorry. What was that?
Is there any other business model where the inventor of the product doesn't actually share in the revenue of the product? No.
Well, I mean, we do share. That is what residuals are, but they make sure that we share in a way that is not representative of the actual success.
I mean, you're being treated like manufacturing. It's like a manufacturing thing. You're there to just churn out scripts. They sell them, get what they can for you, and you get paid your rate for churning out scripts.
Yeah, and this is part of the other problem. The residual is the back end. That's not technically back end. Back end is ownership, which you only get when you're very high up. The residual is the rough TV and network and film equivalent of author's royalties. Like I said, very similar to that.
Yeah.
They get them, we get them, but we get a very denigrated part of them, and our numbers don't go up in streaming if they are more successful, which is a problem.
Uh-huh.
So the guy who writes Stranger Things, which is a giant international hit, gets the exact same check. There's somebody who writes a show you've never heard of.
That's fascinating.
Yes, and so one of our young men that work for our YouTube channel is wearing a Stranger Things sweatshirt right now. So funny, yeah. funny you should say that.
Oh, so, we definitely go get booked. So what happened though is because of the nature of the streaming model, when shows were on broadcast or even on cable, which is where I came up, the production cycle was linked to the distribution cycle. We made the television shows, we wrote, we came up with the ideas, we rewrote during production, we did post and editing, we were on set for the shooting.
Right.
And because we overlapped with production.
Mm-hmm.
But now the streaming companies are like, well, you know what, let's try to stretch these out. We're only making 8-10 episodes, so why don't we get out the scripts first, that way we can budget. And that's kind of the way to seduce you. They go like, oh, well, we get all 10 scripts first. That way we can budget more effectively and get more on the screen. Your show will look better. And this is how we kind of wound up here. It's like, oh, yeah, that does sound great, doesn't it? But you're going to bring us back to be on set.
Right.
No, we're not going to bring you back to be on set. Oh, but post, like editing, is actually part of our job. So you're going to pay us the same as you pay us to be around for that. No, none of you are going to be around for that.
Now, it seems
only the showrunner, and even he is not going to get paid what he usually gets paid for doing the job that he did, absolutely the same job he did 5 years ago.
So I think,
and that's it. They've slowly peeled apart the production cycle into pieces so they can eat away at us at every different stage of the piece.
So in turning you guys into, you know, basically gig workers, right? Turning you into the Uber drivers of Hollywood.
Well, let me ask you something, John.
That's 100% what they're trying to do.
And how many successful showrunners and producers started out as writers? Because right now it sounds like writers are being put in a spot where you're there to write, you have no place in the rest of it, so you have no way to learn the rest of the industry. Like, I would imagine a lot of successful showrunners, producers, started out as writers, figured out set design, music, all of that stuff. And now they're just being cut out. So you're almost shutting off the pipeline to kind of create talent in-house in the entertainment industry.
You know, we make this. Look, almost every showrunner started as a baby writer.
Yeah.
Almost every showrunner worked their way up to the system. Occasionally they go outside and they get a film writer or a playwright who has a lot. But we always pair those people with a showrunner because a television show is a $100 to $200 million business with weekly deadlines. Like, you just don't drop somebody who doesn't know what they're doing into a job like that with 200 employees, several of whom are very good looking and sometimes don't want to come out of their trailer, you know, and, you know, there are transpo issues. There are location issues. Like, this is an enormous business.
So let me ask you this.
Running a show.
Let me ask you this. Because I really do want to touch on this, I think, at least either put it to rest or talk about it. But the article that I read said that that the studios or the employers, I should say, the companies, and these companies, by the way, I read that some of the CEO salaries, they're sickening. Unbelievable. Almost $1 billion for like 6 people. But anyway, I just have to ask you this question, John. They won't even talk about AI. Like, dead silence about AI, right?
Worse than a silence, a mealy-mouth agreement, which makes us actually more worried.
What is that? What is it?
Because what happened is we said, you know, we have these rules for AI, and I was on the AI working group for the Writers Guild. It was led by a guy, a very prescient guy named Derek Hughes, who early in the process said, okay, we need to tackle this now.
Yes.
Right. Get ahead of it, which is why we're one of the first unions out of the gate with an AI policy in our negotiation that other people are looking at and saying, you know, this is great work. That's thanks to Derek Hughes. But I was one of the researchers on that group. And, you know, we said, look, we want to limit it in these ways. And the studios have said, well, no, we don't want to cut ourselves off from being able to explore this technology artistically. So let's have a meeting once a year to talk about it.
Interesting.
And I'm sure that meeting will be how awesome AI is.
Yeah.
Will generally be it. Their big comeback for a lot of the stuff we asked for was, well, let's have a meeting about it. It's like, we don't want to do more free work. We're having negotiations, free work.
We're here right now.
The meeting with you is work.
Yeah, that's right. That's why it's called negotiations. Right? So we don't need meetings. Let's negotiate this.
So I had read that a couple of the items that the WGA is concerned about is not only trying to keep AI from writing source material that gets developed into screenplays and things like that, but also to prevent AI from being used to fix scripts. So a writer could come in with an idea and they'd say, we like part of it, we're going to have AI work on the rest. So what it sounds like to me is, and coming from construction, if you have technological advancement coming in and you give that up, you give human work to technology, you never get it back. So what you're doing right now is fighting to keep human beings in the entertainment industry.
I think it's a very complicated issue because, first of all, the technology can't actually do what they think it can do.
Right.
And a lot of what we're trying to do is keeping boneheaded executives from thinking this is a great idea and driving things into the ground because someone's going to think, oh, let's do this.
Yeah.
And things will be ruined.
But
it's also the fact that, we're trying to keep copyright is a very complicated thing. And these machines are plagiarism machines. These machines have been trained on the copywritten material, our work, without our consent, by the way, violating our copyright. And if you get into copyright in AI, it's interesting because the original guys who developed it, when they were asked, like, oh, did you guys get permission before you scanned the whole internet and all that copywritten material? It very much went from this is the future to, well, we're not responsible for how it's used.
Right.
You use it. Like, they realize they kind of screwed up.
Yeah.
And there have been several judgments recently that said you cannot copyright material created by an AI because of several of those issues. That's not a work of human imagination or human art.
Interesting.
But yeah. I mean, I don't think a lot of this is, I don't think AI is going to replace human workers. But what we're trying to do is basically keep AI from being used as shortcuts to undermine jobs that will be done better by humans anyway, but hard to explain to them why, because they, like, look, the thing you were saying earlier, right, where writers are no longer trained to become showrunners, this is going to cause a problem because you're going to run out of showrunners, or the showrunners you get will be poorly trained, and their shows will go over budget, which is stuff that happens.
Yeah.
These things are always trained next. We tell them that every year. And one of the things where you come on the board when they bring you on as a Writers Guild member on the board, it's always great because the first thing they go is, well, why don't we just tell them they're eating their seed corn? They don't. And you see the glaze in the old board member's eyes.
Sure.
It's like we tell them every year, they don't care. They used to not care because they really didn't want to give up the point. The new group of executives, and I do not think we can underestimate this, the new group of executives are fully of the vulture capital, hedge fund financialization model of Hollywood, where if it does not boost the stock, if what's coming out of your mouth doesn't boost the stock price for the next quarter, they do not hear it.
Yeah.
Cutthroat capitalism is what our previous guest called it, and I think you're right. And we're racing to the bottom here, but let's end on a positive note. How has the support been for your strike?
The sports been, like we said, universal. But the guild itself was completely united. We always get a few holdouts.
Yep.
But the tone here within the industry and outside the industry, I'll address both. Within the industry, a complete sea change from 2007-2008.
Right.
The Teamsters. We had a big meeting at the Spine Auditorium the other day. After we declared the strike, we had several thousand guild members there to go over the negotiations and explain why we had to do this. And we had every labor union in Hollywood represented in that room.
That's
the
awesome.
Hollywood Laborers Union, the people who maintained the lot, were there.
Yeah.
The cementers and plasterers were there.
Yeah.
The Teamsters were there. The directors and actors were there. IATSE was there. We've never had this.
That's
and they
great.
All got up to speak.
That's great.
And
what about from the public? Because the public now has a very favorable view of unions. And I think, at least from what I'm reading, very supportive of what you guys are doing. How's that been?
Yeah, I mean, you've got this sort of usual thing where people have been so steeped in, well, the corporation is always right, when they just don't understand that you're allowed to say no.
Yeah.
You know, we've got a little bit of that in the fringe. But I think that's the other thing, is it was really hard to explain in 2007, 2008 to the general public.
Sure.
Well, you know, there's copyright issues and streaming. It's like, I don't understand either of those words. But you can absolutely go to the public now that has watched this happen in every business in America.
Right.
And they've had their family members suffer from this. Hey, the bosses are making giant profits and not paying the workers. You don't have to sell anyone in America on that.
Right. We've been talking with John Rogers. He is an executive board member for the WGA
Writers
West.
Guild of America.
Yep, Writers Guild of America. And, hey, John, we appreciate your being on. This is really, really timely and really important, and we wish you all the best.
Guys, I appreciate you having us on. I appreciate the work you're doing. We're not going to have a future unless people start waking up to the fact we have to do this together.
Absolutely.
Right. Thank you, John.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah, we'll be right back right here on 720 WGN, the Workers' Mic.
You're listening to The Workers' Mic, powered by the Midwest Coalition of Labor and sponsored by Megan Financial, Premise Health, and Voya Financial.
Welcome back, everyone, to The Workers' Mic right here on 720 WGN. That was super, super interesting.
That was. I could have listened to a lot more. And actually, I think on the broadcast, we're going to have a little bit extra to that interview that's going to be on the YouTube channel. So once you're done listening to the show on WGN this morning, head on over to YouTube and look up The Workers' Mic, and you can hear the rest of what John Rogers from the WGA had to say.
Yeah, it's hard to get all this into a short period of time.
There's a
lot of complicated issues, but you know, at the end of the day, what I took away was they're really, really fighting for not just the middle class. They're fighting for jobs.
Yeah.
Right? They're fighting for the future.
Yeah.
You know, if we're going to be replaced by robots, right?
Right.
I mean, this is coming from a guy that wrote Transformers.
I know. See, I mean, he knows all about bad AI, you could say.
We need good AI to fight
the bad AI.
John, if you're listening still, just make a good robot to fight the bad robot.
If I remember correctly, sometimes they hide as meteors, so you got to look closely for the good AI. Did you ever see Transformers?
No.
You should watch it. It's really, really
I heard
great.
I heard it was transformative.
It was a very well-written movie.
Was And John's interview was, you know, it transformed my opinion.
Transformative indeed.
Stupid.
But yeah, I mean, I guess pretty soon, if this continues on, there won't be any more TV, and we're going to have to open our doors and go outside.
And read.
Yeah, maybe like walk around, ride bikes.
Play cards again.
Get exercise.
Right.
Talk to friends, family.
It's going to be real. That's going to, like, actually sit next to your wife and talk to her. Like, oh, boring.
Yeah, and there's no TV to watch.
You know how many divorces will it be? Like, instead of like, hey, honey, let's not talk and binge watch TV for the next 6 hours. They have to sit there and look at each other.
Newspaper subscriptions are going to go up, so guys can just sit there and pretend they're reading the paper.
You and I might be replaced by robots.
They could probably do it better than me.
Yeah, well, me too.
Well, thanks everybody so much. It was a great show, great guest. Thanks for sticking with us, and we'll be back here with more Workers' Mic next week right here on 720 WGN.
The preceding episode of The Workers' Mic was powered by the Midwest Coalition of Labor and sponsored by Megan Financial, Premise Health, and Voya Financial. For additional information and podcasts of The Workers' Mic, visit WGNRadio.com.